This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. In 2006, David Peters was a chaplain for the 62nd Engineer Combat Battalion in Baghdad, responsible for repairing roads and building guard towers. It was dangerous work, often done at night. If one of the soldiers was injured or dying or needed someone to talk to, or the unit was dealing with the aftermath of a fatal attack, word went out to get the expletive chaplain, and Peters was there. The war changed him by challenging his faith in God. It also changed his marriage. His wife began having an affair when he was in Iraq, and they later divorced. David Peters' memoir, Death Letter, God, Sex, and War, is a brutally honest description of this period of his life. He was angry and in pain, drinking a lot, looking for lots of sex in hopes they'd take away his anguish. He remarried. In fact, he and his wife are about to have a baby. He's also an Episcopal minister now in Texas and a U.S. Army Reserve chaplain, and he joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. And David Peters, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here with you.
Let me start with the title of your book. I'll get to the subtitle, but the title of your book is Death Letter. What's a death letter?
A death letter is a letter that soldiers and probably other people write to when they realize that they might be facing their own death or going into an experience where they're going to have a high likelihood of death. When I got to Iraq, I wrote one. I hand wrote it on some Red Cross stationery because I wasn't sure what would happen to me. Right before I'd gotten there, a dentist had been blown up in a vehicle convoy, and I thought, well, if they blew up a dentist, maybe a chaplain would not be so any luckier in that way. So the death letter is, you know, put in a locker or back of a wall locker or somewhere safe to be opened on the unfortunate death of the person that wrote it, and it's mailed back to the family, and people get to read it. So I wrote that, and when I first got there,
you ripped that one up. You wrote a second one, but I'm trying to sort of imagine both one's death, and perhaps in Iraq at that time it was possible to do that, but also trying to imagine one's family and perhaps friends receiving this letter that's sent to them in the future.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that all people that join the military and deploy into a combat zone have to face is their own death. And there's like a line that I noticed people crossing, and I remember crossing it myself, where I became accepting of that fate if it were to happen. And that's some of the numbness that comes from war. And it doesn't just click off when we come home. It kind of stays there, the numbness of being willing to and ready to even die.
In fact, you describe the difference between, training for the war. You joined the Marines, the kind of war face that you might have in training, and the blank face that you wore, if I can use that, when you were in Iraq. The blank face, which is just expressionless.
Indeed. One of the strange things about combat that I noticed when I was there was how normal everything was. War is such an absurd experience for the way I had lived my whole life. It was so different, and yet within just a few days the whole culture of war became a very normal thing. So whenever something happened, whether it was an explosion or even an accident or anything that would have been just completely out of the norm here in the United States, was just so normal. We all just took it in stride. We all thought it was the way life always had been. I think most soldiers adjust to that experience really fast. It's the other part, the coming home, that is a little more difficult.
You grew up in a religious family in Pennsylvania. What was your faith growing up?
I grew up in a tradition that put a lot of emphasis on God's control in the world, the sovereignty of God over all events, even some of the bad events in life. This is mostly me. The way I attached to that belief was that I really felt like it was a lucky charm necklace that I could hang around my neck, that if I were to follow all these rules and all these commandments and really live in this community, then the bad things that happen to other people might not happen to me. Things like divorce or even injury and other things. I felt like maybe if I do everything right, I'll have a happy life, a perfect life. And this was a bargain I had made. No one really ever said that explicitly to me, but that's how I appropriated that faith as a child and as a teenager and as a young man.
Do you think you went to Iraq to test that faith? Because you couldn't have been that naive about war at that time.
The thing I noticed about myself about war was after having served in the Marines and never deploying into a combat zone while I was serving in the Marine Corps, when the invasion of Iraq happened, this is part of my almost confession in some ways of realizing how excited I was to be part of something like a war. I thought it had passed me by as a younger man, and now I think I was 27 when I became a chaplain, which is still quite young, but for military standards, it's quite old. And I thought, well, this is my chance. And I was excited to be tested in that way, to experience something I'd never experienced. And so I think that excitement, and excitement not just in a positive way, but in the kind of, will I have what it takes to make it through, was overshadowed a lot of my knowledge of what I might face there.
I'd love to have you read a section. This is chapter 3, the very beginning. It's titled Anna, Baghdad, Iraq, 3 weeks into deployment. Could you read that for us?
Sure. I'm at a Army Forward Operating Base, or FOB, in Baghdad, Iraq. I've been here for 3 weeks, and I'm lying on the floor listening to the rockets roar over my little shed. The little wooden building shakes like a cheap apartment beside the train tracks. The floor of the office is dusty, but I don't notice the dust until the moment I realize I'm trying to burrow deeper into the floor. If a rocket hits near the building, I want to be low enough to avoid the shrapnel. I know that if I'm standing when the rocket hits nearby, a jagged piece of steel could sail over the concrete barrier outside my office and rip through my neck. One more rocket roars over the office, and then all I hear is the whirring of the fan and the beating of my own heart. I never knew war could be so full of contradictions, so full of things that just don't belong together. I can feel my heartbeat against the thin wood of the office floor. I've heard rockets before, but this time they whiz right over the little shed. War is loud. The explosions and bombs are so loud that I feel the sound waves hitting me in the chest and my ears ring for hours. I always wear earplugs with the hope that I'll have something left when I rotate back to Texas. I sometimes wish there were other ways to dampen the impact of war on my senses.
And that's our guest, David W. Peters, reading a section from his memoir, a book called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. Listening to you read that and reading that that section of the book over the weekend, is there anything that can prepare someone for what war sounds like, what war smells like?
Well, the training I went through in the Marine Corps and in the Army both was an attempt to do that, to take a individual, a person that for the most part is, you know, maybe played sports or other things like that, and really put them in an environment where they're not just willing to die for their country, but willing to kill for it. And that experience of experiencing the loud noises, and that's always a part of training. It's always, they always have flashbangs and things, but the real stuff's a lot louder.
Sure,
as I found out. But to be able to, those are the punctuations of war. But one of the other things I noticed over there was that I didn't notice at the time, but I've noticed since I came back, was there's also a slow drip of fear that is in the air in a war zone, and it stresses everybody out because you have to be ready to react at any moment. You have to be ready to dive on the floor, jump under your bunk, jump in the bunker, carry someone, drag someone at any time. And you're always wondering, will I have what it takes when that happens? Will I know what to do? Will I do it right? And that constant alertness, that hyper arousal, that really doesn't go away for a lot of veterans we come back.
Do chaplains carry weapons in war?
No. Since for a number of years, the Army chaplains and all chaplains in the U.S. military don't have chosen not to carry weapons, although the Geneva Convention does allow for that. We just don't carry weapons for a lot of reasons, but that was certainly gave me a unique perspective on on war.
Because
we have a chaplain assistant that that goes with us everywhere we go. I had a really great chaplain assistant who went with me everywhere I went in Iraq, and she carried an M16, and she was there to protect me, and I was always with a number of soldiers that were there to protect each other and protect me. So I always felt safe in that sense, although there's nothing anyone can do about a bomb on the side of the road or under your vehicle.
Your book, and I can't say this on the radio, but you write it in your book about getting the expletive chaplain. And you write about, even under those circumstances, that it sounded like you thought your job was to, quote unquote, carry their stories. And these would be the stories from soldiers who had been through something tough. What do you mean by carry their stories?
There's certainly soldiers tell stories to each other in war. They process their experiences that way after every mission and even during them. But talking to the chaplain often is a much more vulnerable and confessional experience for each person because the chaplain embodies that the love of God. And it's a very maternal role. I soon found out that to be able to listen to people and care for them and withhold judgment from them, the military is a institution that thrives on perfection, not just of our brass on our uniforms and polishing it, but of procedure and mission. And so in a war zone, Murphy's Law of things going wrong just happens all the time. And mistakes are made and people forget things and change course. And so there's a number of things every single day where people fail. And that's the nature of war, is that it creates situations where ordinary people just can't do everything right. And those are the kind of things that I listen to, the stories of things not going always the way everyone thought they would go. And so carrying that burden of kind of knowing every horrible thing that was going on in a unit of maybe 1,000 men and women at any given time, and others from other units. And I didn't realize how much that was weighing on me while I was there. And when I came home, especially, I didn't really understand that would be a burden. And I think nurses, doctors, psychiatrists, counselors, and certainly chaplains have the very similar effects of compassion fatigue and secondary trauma from all the experiences that just pile up inside us.
And I do want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's David Peters. He's an Episcopal priest in Austin, Texas. He also serves as a chaplain in the U.S. Army Reserve. And his new book, Death Letter, God, Sex, and War, written shortly after he returned from Iraq. He enlisted in the Marine Corps the day after his high school graduation. In fact, graduated from the Chapel Christian Academy in Limerick, Pennsylvania. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, David Peters is our guest. He was deployed to Iraq in 2006 as the battalion chaplain for the 62nd Engineer Combat Battalion. It was a unit charged with repairing roads and constructing guard towers. He was there for a year. His book is about both his experiences in Iraq and also the challenges he faced coming home. As it turned out, his wife was having an affair, and he was struggling with his own faith, his own view of God. And his book is called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. David, you had a piece in the Huffington Post recently, and you wrote, "When I return from Iraq, I tell as many stories as I can to anyone who will listen. I'm never finished talking about it. I do this for 3 weeks. I realize that no one gets the point of what I want to say, so I stop telling stories." This is also a piece where family members would say to you about their veteran family member who had gone to war, he just never talks about it. I mean, the difficulty, I guess, both of getting someone to talk about it or wanting to talk about it, and then finding the words to describe what really happened there and how one feels.
Indeed. One thing that all veterans tell me that they experience, and I've experienced this myself, is we don't trust anybody. The relationships in combat that we forge are so intimate, so close. And so when we come home, we don't usually have the same people around us. They go their separate ways and we go ours. And so now we're into a world where not everyone was there with us, and we don't trust anybody. Even family members are really hard to trust. And I found that to be a pretty universal experience all the way back in the literature of coming home from war. And it still continues today. So just getting, just being with a veteran and listening to their stories or any stories so that they can build that trust is really a huge step. And it's a bigger one, I think, than most people know.
Your book is written in the present tense. And my understanding, it was written really as a kind of journal or diary shortly after you came back from the war. And it is very honest, I should say. It doesn't sound like a minister writing some of this stuff. I will add that as well. There are also some funny parts as well, but it is written in the present tense, which gives it a kind of focus and intensity.
Yeah, I was living in this world that I didn't quite understand. Oh, yet I knew that some part of me had really changed. And this I found later is a pretty common experience. One is of PTSD. One is a foreshortened future when you don't think you're going to live very long anymore. So to make any future plans are just kind of out the window. Also, for a lot of veterans, we experience this shutdown of our decision maker, our smarter brain, and the limbic, our reptilian brain kind of takes over. And that's the part that, you know, our sexual part and our just moving ahead in the world. So I was constantly in motion. I couldn't stand still. I was moving from one thing to the next. I'd lost so much in my own family and my own church and my own life that I was really drifting. And in that time, I found that writing helped. I joined a group at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in D.C. that would meet after work, and we'd bring a paragraph or two that we'd written. And Robert Johnson, he was working at the Pentagon at the time, would come up and lead that group. And I found that when I'd read something that I'd written, the other group members would affirm me in that and respond sometimes with their own stories and with their own reflections on war. And I found that to be really helpful for me to set in ink some kind of marker that maybe if I wouldn't be around much longer, there would be at least something left of me.
Were you in any way hesitant to publish, because you didn't just write this for yourself, it's now been published, which is about your sexual encounters, your problems with sexual performance, if I can put it that way. Are you comfortable with that out in the public?
Yeah, well, I'm not always comfortable with anything in life. And yet I found that the emails and calls and letters and just verbal affirmation I get from mostly veterans and family members of veterans that tell me, yeah, that's how it was when I came home, or I experienced that too, or my son experienced that. One of the most touching letters I got was from a woman whose son died 2 years ago as a homeless veteran in the American Southwest. And she wrote that to me that she felt like her son was talking to her. And that touched me a lot, because I knew that I had a lot of shame about my problems, especially my relationship with women. And I had a lot of shame about my experiences coming home from war and how I acted and how I dealt with it and how I didn't deal with it. And I found that one of the antidotes to shame is vulnerability. And to really be a priest and to be a minister requires a lot of vulnerability. If we ask other people to share with us things, if we ask people to be honest about their own lives, we have to be honest about ours, I think. And that's what I was trying to do by publishing this, although I had a lot of nervousness and I was scared to death and a lot of anxiety. I kept the manuscript away for a long time. Even when Tactical 16, their great disabled veteran-owned publisher, was, you know, saying, yeah, we're ready to roll with this project, I delayed and delayed and delayed because I was just terrified of what people would think of me when they found out I was a human being. And that's, I found that experience wasn't as bad as I thought. And it was actually my wife, Sarah, that encouraged me to go ahead with it, because that story needed to be told.
Were you afraid, and you do acknowledge this at the end of the book, that people would judge your first wife, and she was having an affair, actually an affair with a neighbor, a man that you knew and jogged with and did things with. Are you afraid that people would judge her?
Well, I think our natural reaction is always to judge when we hear about someone doing something that is we deem immoral. And the truth of all this is that every single person involved in the story, my ex-wife and the neighbor, and we're all victims of war. We all experienced deployments. We all experienced that really trauma that we didn't quite understand as trauma at the time. And people react in very strange ways to when circumstances turn our worlds upside down. I was not a very reflective person when I joined the military. The military doesn't encourage reflection, and there's a good reason for that. We can't get too philosophical in combat, reflecting on everything. We have to react and act in a way that makes a difference in the moment. And so, I felt like, well, when it comes to other people's issues, I feel like, well, you didn't want me to write about it. Maybe you shouldn't have done it.
Well, let me pick up on that. I mean, in hindsight, and of course, this is, 2015. So you went to Iraq in 2006 and thinking about your wife's affair. But in hindsight, as you look at it now, does it make sense to you? Do you understand why she did what she did?
I think that I don't know if I always think this, but I've thought this a few times that a lot of times adultery and affairs are really because of an imbalance in a relationship. And certainly I came home from Iraq very numb, very jaded. And most spouses of soldiers will say this about their loved one. They'll say he or she came back really different. And I didn't realize I was different. I thought the whole world had changed. I thought everybody else was different. I thought I was just happy to be able to, you know, use a toilet in the middle of the night and happy to just have running water and other things that were real luxuries back here. And be with my kids and my family. And other than that, I really had very little empathy for anyone else around me. And I think that if that kind of alienation often leads to affairs, that kind of distance and lack of intimacy leads to marital discord, and it certainly leads to the changing of a relationship. Almost every relationship and of every person I knew that came back from Iraq changed in some way. Most of the relationships had to start over. They had to start from zero. Husbands and wives that had been married for a number of years had to just start over. Most of the engaged folks that were engaged broke up, and boyfriends and girlfriends broke up. Married people had a little more reason to stay together, especially if they had kids, and yet even most of those marriages didn't last much longer because of all the changes. I wasn't aware of how much war changed me, but it certainly changed me. And I didn't realize that everyone loses something in a war. I just wasn't aware of what it would be. I kind of knew that I would maybe come back a little different, but I didn't think it would be in a relational way with my ex-wife.
Let me reintroduce you. That's David Peters, and he has written a book called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War, a book that he wrote after returning from Iraq. He was a chaplain for an army unit in Baghdad in 2006. He's currently an Episcopal minister. He's also a chaplain for the U.S. Army Reserve, and we are talking about what war was like for him, how he has dealt with some of the aftermath. We were just talking about the fact that he and his wife divorced. She began having an affair while he was in Iraq, all something that he writes about in this book. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. David, as I said, this book is very honest, and you describe going into the Marine Corps boot camp. This is shortly after high school. I mean, you really were a virgin. You'd never had sex before. Mm-hmm. You had never had a drink. You come back from war, and you see what's happening with your family, and it seems like you're in this desperate search to have sex with women, if I can put it that way, but mm-hmm. also in a kind of almost like a vengeful way to somehow punish women. Do I have that?
Yeah, I think, and I wasn't aware of this at the time, but I was extremely angry. I think sometimes anger has a way of creating a lack or creating a situation where the person that's angry isn't always aware of how angry we are. And I was really angry. I was angry mostly at myself because I felt like I was to blame for everything that had gone wrong. I had internalized that blame. And that's something that military training does encourage. And certainly sometimes religion can encourage, too, to blame yourself for your own shortcomings. So I had so much of that shame going on that and anger and frustration that I really didn't have any empathy for other people. I was worried about my own well-being, my own ego. And so I would go through a series of relationships of getting really close and then just cutting it off and then getting close again and cutting it off. And that started to lead to real disillusionment of whether I'd ever be able to have a relationship last for more than a couple weeks or a month or two.
You drank a lot. I mean, as I said, you grew up in a family that eschewed drinking, but you would pick up women at bars. I mean, this seems like you were another person, or maybe acting out a certain role or part that was kind of alien to how you had been.
Yeah, when I went to Washington, D.C., and I was working as a chaplain at Walter Reed Army Medical Center with the most severely wounded folks of the war, the amputees, sometimes quadruple amputees, and I also worked in the psych ward there with many soldiers who had attempted suicide, and many of them had killed enemy soldiers, and some of them had accidentally killed civilians, and so there was a real weight of that place. And so I'd come home from that every day, and everyone that I knew there that worked there with me was going through a similar kind of transition in life. So to enter another culture, we lived in this culture of what we call the secondhand smoke of war, this hot army hospital full of wounded folks and their families. So coming home from that at the end of the day, we all tried to escape in many ways, any ways we could. My escape was to try to meet women and have sex with them. That was one way I was able to try to really recreate myself, and also to drink a lot, because that took away the symptoms and the some of the anger and the feelings of despair that I was feeling. And then they all came right back. That's the thing with drinking. It only takes it away for a short time. And that's the true with sex, too. It only changes the reality for just a short time.
Was your family worried about you? Did they know what was going on with you?
I think they definitely were. I know my parents were, and they cared about me a lot and did just about everything they could to help me during that time. And as I was going back and forth from Washington, D.C. to Pennsylvania, my two boys were living in Pennsylvania at the time. And they were really sheltering of me. And yet I was pretty good at keeping everything secret. And that's kind of what a lot of veterans do. We have a lot of respect from communities often, that because we were in a war and we came home, so that we get this respect instantly, and we can hide a lot of our problems with that kind of that shield of respect. And most everybody goes through a real big transition. I was going through one, and I don't think most people knew about it, because I was able to keep the beach ball under the water. Mm. There was a few times it popped out, and that was always really scary for me.
I bet. That's a great metaphor. I mean, one knows exactly what it is that you're talking about there. How about your faith in God? I mean, as you said, you went to war perhaps thinking that God would protect people.
I did. I had always wrestled with that question of why bad things happen to people, why, you know, children are murdered and people are maimed and lose things. And I'd wrestled with that intellectual question. In Iraq, taking that God that of justice and things into that war, it really came into question when I witnessed some of the cruelties of war, not the overt ones where women and children are massacred by the enemy or by our soldiers or anything like that, but really the small cruelties of being an occupying force in a country that was in a huge transition. When we'd drive around Baghdad, we'd sometimes have sirens on our vehicles or flashing lights or just weapons that we'd point at people, and They'd have to get out of our way. And that kind of just dealing with traffic in that way really, I think, changes most of the people that participated in that forever. That kind of power that we had so much power over there, power of life and death. And that's a power only God has. And yet we had it. We could kill and we could get away with it. And that sort of power, I think, changed me and most of the folks that went over there. So when I came back and felt powerless and helpless, and then my marriage failed, and I was just left with what I felt like was nothing. And then my church, I lost my credentials, my ordination credentials in my church because I was divorced. And I was just felt like I'd lost everything. And that's when I felt like God had let me down, because I had kept the deal. I had been serving as a minister. I had, you know, been a virgin when I was married. I had done everything right, I felt. And then I felt betrayed by God. And so most of my anger was directed at myself and at the God that had let me down in that time. And so I just felt abandoned. And that sense of being alone, the existentialists like Nietzsche and others talk about looking into the abyss and feeling the abyss look back into you. And I definitely felt that. And the despair led to a lot of self-destruction. And that's really what the relationship trauma was about, and the drinking and even the thoughts of suicide.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with David Peters, David W. Peters. He's got a book called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. He is joining us from the studios in Austin, Texas of KUT, and he is an Episcopal minister now. He was not raised Episcopal. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, again talking with David Peters about his book called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. We do have some callers that want to join our conversation, also some comments as well. David, did you have to then kind of reconstruct a new God for yourself?
I did. It happened kind of serendipitously, if you will. I stumbled on some of the writings of a World War I German army chaplain named Paul Tillich, and he eventually became a professor in the United States at Union Seminary and University of Chicago, and after he moved to America in the 1930s. But he was a World War I army chaplain, very similar to me in some ways. He went off to war with a God that would protect him and everybody else. And as he buried countless of his own friends and colleagues and soldiers, all that fell apart. He came back to a wife that was pregnant with a friend's baby, and his marriage fell apart. He went through a really wild time, but his theology of who God was and is really resonated with me at that time when I came back and I was searching. He would say things that were very provocative, like, God does not exist. God is existence himself. And he was an existentialist who rattled a lot of cages, but he also felt that this idea of a God that is always on our side just is going to fall apart when the trials of life came. So that was my first step back. And then little by little, I was like most veterans who can't trust anybody. So trusting God was almost completely impossible, and I was so angry. But little by little, some of the light started to break back into my life. The further I went into the darkness, the more of the cracks would kind of, and the more cracked my life became, the more the light would break in. And slowly and surely, I realized that I had to start giving trust back to people and to God. I had to kind of give that gift first before I would wait for a really long time for someone to earn it. And so I started trusting a few people. And one of them happened to be an Episcopal priest in Washington, D.C., and others that kind of brought me back into the fold of the faith in that way. And so I don't intellectualize it as much. I think God might be a lot more like sex and war, more of an experience than something we can always nail down and a person we can always think we know everything about. I'm a lot more mystical and mysterious about things now.
Well, and it is, I guess, from the way you describe it, giving up a more literal description or even understanding of God to a much more existential, even abstract view of God.
Indeed. Yeah, I agree with that. I definitely moved in a more existentialist direction. And by that, I mean that God is an experience, that we experience God in our reality. And that's the Christmas story of the incarnation, that this God becomes flesh and lives among us. So our flesh is somehow sacred in a way that it hasn't ever been before. And so I slowly and surely found that the more I trusted, the more I felt like God was breaking into my life. And I had one experience where probably the only time God ever spoke to me that I would ever say God spoke to me was I was so angry at God, and I was just pissed off. And I can say that
you
I was
just angry. But that's okay. No, go ahead.
And I
you're the priest here. I'm not me.
Sorry, I've been around soldiers. Most
I know.
Of my life.
I could tell.
And I was just so angry, and I was so felt so betrayed and so abandoned that I just screamed and shouted at God and asked him, why did you do this to me? And in that moment, I heard a voice that said, you know, you can leave her now.
You can leave her now.
Yeah, I was really, I wasn't quite yet divorced. We were struggling through that process, and I just couldn't let go emotionally. I couldn't, I wanted my marriage to last forever. And I didn't believe it at the time that was kind of a message to me, but because it was so unexpected, I always thought that God wanted everybody to stay married forever. And so the God that appeared in that moment was not a God I expected to be there. And I found that to be true for most things with God, that the God that I had always constructed in my own mind and heart was not really the ultimate reality in the universe, that God disappeared in war in Iraq. And yet this new experience with God kind of came back to me and after that.
Mm. We have a question from Raphael. He said, how did he, meaning you, David, how did he get through all the disappointment? Why did he feel abandoned? How did he manage to do the right thing? Because so part of this is obviously this collapse of your marriage. You had a couple of kids at the time. In fact, you're just about to have a baby even as we speak here.
Any minute now.
Any minute now, apparently. But, you know, the working through the feelings of loneliness and abandonment.
Well, I did what a lot of people do when we feel lonely and abandoned. I tried to numb it. I tried to figure out a way out to escape the bad feeling. And what I'm learning, and I go to a group at the VA now. I was there Friday, where part of the exercises we do is to sit with really difficult to deal with emotions. And these are not skills we always learn in the military or even in religion, but to sit with our feelings that are just kind of crazy and out of control and try to be with them for a little bit, because those feelings are part of us. So I found that just allowing my feelings to kind of just run and look at them and evaluate them and then act after I've experienced all that flood of emotion. Because I know one thing that most of us deal with when we come home is intense anger. And most veterans have a anger response that goes from 0 to 10 in a really quick time period. It's just a flash. And folks from World War II and Vietnam, and if you've grown up with a combat veteran in your house, you know, as a child, you know that how quick that anger is. And that's a natural response to combat. You have to be able to do that in war. You have to be able to go from 0 to 10 and neutralize a threat or get away from something. And so I found that just sitting with those intense feelings of anger and rage and despair really helped me move and become more comfortable with them, which was ultimately me becoming more comfortable with myself. And I think that groups help, trusting a couple other veterans, whether it's at the VA or at a church group or anywhere, trusting a couple other people to kind of carry you through those experiences are really the things that help me.
I'd love to have you read another section from the book. This is on page 59, chapter 8, Patricia, Washington, D.C., after redeployment.
Yeah. Most men think they know something about war, for they have seen war movies. Most people can tell from a few details of my life that I've been in one or more. It's not hard to figure out. Sometimes I feel like a Vietnam vet in his olive drab green jacket with all the patches, hoping that someone will notice. Men ask me what it is like to be in a war. what it was like to go through that. I've lost all my good lines, all my good answers. I talk about the erosion of trust and how good it feels to know how you will die. Then I'm quiet. All I can say is that being in a war for a year is like working in a brothel for a year. If someone came to you and told you they worked in a brothel for the last couple years, what would you say? What would you ask them? Could they say anything that would make any sense? War is like a brothel. War has its own smells, its own touches. These are some things you cannot learn unless you are there. All the war movies in the world never smell like a war. They never feel like a war. I know what it smells like. I know how it feels. I also know that nothing in this world smells or feels like that world. We fantasize about brothels like we fantasize about war, and we're wrong about both. When we know, we realize that there are no more words.
And again, that's our guest, David W. Peters, reading from his book, A Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. So are you done writing about war? Do you feel like you have written what war has been to you, or you have more to say?
Well, I certainly have moved from just detailing the experiences of my own suffering and anguish and anger, which I did in this book, beyond that, to be a little more reflective about the universal experience of war. So I right now, one of the greatest joys of my life is to meet with a group of veterans on Tuesday nights, and we meet in a church basement and here in Austin, and we share our experience. We always have a time of lament where we bring a poem or a song or something we wrote or maybe something someone made, and we share a story about that, and we share that piece of art that we've created out of our experiences. And those are really special moments for me. So, yeah, I want to help all of us come home from war, because that's going to take a while.
We have a Facebook comment from Tika saying, when did you realize that you had changed and the world had changed? When did he come home? This is you, David. When did he come home to his awakening from PTSD and decided to honestly get help for what he was going through? And what advice would you give to families who are dealing with vets who are, quote unquote, numb?
Those are a lot of good questions.
Yep.
Certainly, I started to go to counseling when I started to have trouble in my job and in my relationships, which are always the two reasons why people go talk to a chaplain or talk to anybody. And so I was having trouble in my relationships. I couldn't be with anybody for very long. I noticed that I would just pull away and be distant real fast. And so I went to counseling for that, and that really opened the door for me. I was so ashamed to go sit in that waiting room at the office where they had the counselors, and I was just terrified that someone would see me in there, the chaplain who is supposed to have everything together there. And yet, I found that to be a really liberating experience to share what I was going through with someone else that was not in my social circles or not in my immediate experience, but they were a professional. They were there to help me through that. And I found that to be the first step in getting help with PTSD. And if you live with someone that has PTSD or someone that has a combat experience and really or any traumatic experience, this is not that different from any others. The first thing to do is to listen and to understand that that what they're going through is affecting everything, and that what their actions and their attitudes are often not about you or anybody else. They're about themselves and the things that they lost. So to first, and if we want other people to get help, we have to go get help ourselves. If we live with someone that's suffering, and we want them to go to counseling, the best way to do it is for us to go to start that conversation.
We should add that, it looks like you found love and marriage. You have remarried and, as I said, just about to have a baby. So clearly a happy ending for you, or happy, this is not the end, but a happy middle for you.
It is indeed. And I'd kind of given up on happiness. And I when I met Sarah, my wife, who's expecting any minute now. The birth
truly,
of this
and
child.
That is true, folks. It's true.
It really is. You know, it's all starting. It's been a new birth for me in many ways to have this happen. And yet, even in our relationship, all these things come up a lot. These parts of me that aren't quite healed yet happen a lot. And my wife's really good about making sure that I go get help. And I do that. And I go and make appointments, and I go to the VA, and I go talk with people I trust, because this is a lifelong journey coming home from war. It doesn't just stop the minute you get back in Dallas or Atlanta or wherever we land.
Let me see what Suzanne from, looks like Boyertown has to say. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking this call.
Sure.
Because it really is wonderful to be able to ask this question of an Episcopal priest. I choose to support my relationship with God through the Episcopal Church. And I'm confounded by really not hearing any engagement or discussion about the popularity of the movie American Sniper. And I'm wondering what you have to say or think about that. Mostly I hear no engagement so far about it within my church. And maybe I'm missing something, but as far as I know, I haven't heard anything or read anything. So I'm just wondering, you having had the experience of the war and also your relationship with God, what do you make of this?
Well, Suzanne, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. David, have you had a chance to see this film? Or do you see
films about Iraq? I have tried. I always get it on DVD and I watch it on my laptop because I like to be able to control the experience. One thing about going into the theater, I can't control it. So I'm not there yet where I can go to watch war movies. I can't really do fireworks yet, maybe someday. But one thing that I remember getting, someone sent me a newspaper cutout when I was in Iraq in 2006. And it was some intelligence had been obtained from Al-Qaeda there that they were trying to target with snipers, chaplains and medical personnel. They found this memo somewhere when they had a raid. So I remember getting this clipping saying chaplains and medical personnel had been targeted by enemy snipers. And so I have a personal experience of being grabbed and pulled down when snipers were attacking us at several places there in Baghdad during that year. And yet I think that this war, this movie, American Sniper, if anything, it's created a huge conversation. It's almost like a Rorschach test when you watch it. Everyone has a different reaction of whether it's glorifying war. And we have a strange relationship with violence in America. We are fascinated by it, and we're afraid of it, and we have a lot of feelings about it. And that's one thing that every veteran that's seen the movie that I know has had some kind of really strong reaction to it, which means it's probably speaking to a lot of people. But mm-hmm. as to the question of where it fits into the church experience, one of the things
and
we're
David,
doing...
we only have about 10 seconds for that. Sorry.
We need to churches need to talk about veterans and their issues, and they need to talk about what it's like to go to war and where do you take that stuff when you come home. And I take it right up to the altar and put it on the altar, and that's what we're trying to learn, teach veterans how to do here in Texas.
Well, David Peters, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're so welcome. And the book is called Death Letter, God, Sex, and War. And our guest, David Peters, is an Episcopal priest in Austin, Texas. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks so much for joining us.